Happy Saturday. It is April 6th, 2024, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in New York City.
And I'm Michael Haney, also in New York City.
Hooray! And we are two of your airmail editors that are here to bring you a little bit of good news. Meanwhile, unfortunately, in the real world, in Gaza, an Israeli strike has killed 7 aid workers. In Las Vegas, the fabled Tropicana Hotel is closing its doors for the last time. Meanwhile, in New York, there's a punching phenomenon going on in the subways. Note to self, take city bike. But Michael, airmail and Morning Meeting are the antidote for all of that. So where should we begin?
Well, we've got a great show. First, Kat Rosenfield will explain how we are in the throes of a new sexual revolution. Yet where the baby boomers of 60 years ago were obsessed with the practice of sex, the Zoomers, or Gen Z, as they are known, are more interested in the principle of it. She'll explain all. Then, one of the most anticipated movies of this spring is called Civil War, by the writer and director Alex Garland, and it imagines what a second American Civil War will look like. Our writer, Michael Schwagow, has seen it and is here to tell us all about it. And finally, speaking of movies, Woody Allen has a new film out. It's his 50th, in fact. But Sam Wasson, our man in Los Angeles, has seen it, and he spoke with Woody Allen about the movie, his career, and more. So, Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Michael, let's start with the sex lives of Gen Z. To paraphrase, all blow and no go. Kat Rosenfield, a writer for Airmail and also the author of several books, including No One Will Miss Her, is here to explain it all. Welcome, Kat.
Thank you for having me.
So, Kat, you explore a fascinating, I guess we could call it a phenomenon, which is that 1 in 5 adult members of Gen Z is identifying these days as LGBTQ+. What exactly is going on?
So, yeah, there has in recent years been this big increase in that number, and it's driven by Gen Z and to a lesser degree, millennials identifying as bisexual. So that's sort of the main driver of this. And I think what's very interesting about this story is that the material expression of orientation, who people date and sleep with and marry, doesn't actually seem to be changing all that much. The biggest thing about Gen Z isn't that they're having like a lot more gay sex. It's more that they're not really having sex at all. And I think we're seeing a very generational shift in how people define sexual orientation at the concept level.
Why aren't they having sex at all? What's that about?
That's a good question. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Gen Z is the first generation to come of age in this sort of disembodied way. And as a result, their conversations about sex and sexual orientation exist in the realm of the kind of abstract and theoretical in a way that hasn't been true for people of previous generations. Someone my age or older, if they talk about sexual orientation, they're describing who they want to be naked with and probably based on an experience of having enjoyed previously being naked with somebody in real life. It's based on the embodied experience of sex. Gen Z is having less sex, but they're talking about it more. And when they talk about it, they're not talking about the embodied experience of sex because they're not doing that particularly. And so it becomes very abstract. It's like, what do you like the looks of? What do you like the idea of? It's maybe what kind of pornography do you watch? But the question of actual physical encounters with somebody, that's becoming very de-emphasized or even decoupled from the entire concept of orientation.
It sounds like it's less who you sleep with and more who you want to stand with.
Yeah, I think the thing is that once you have sort of ceased to connect sexual orientation to the question of who do you physically want to be engaged with, it does take on, yeah, not just an abstract valence, but sometimes a political one. It's not just what do you like the idea of liking, it's what kind of person do you want to advertise yourself as. For Gen Z, the stigma of being gay, I think, is pretty minimal at this point. There's just not a lot of stigma attached to coming out as gay. The stigma of being seen as homophobic, however, is really great. And there is a sense in which identifying as bisexual expresses less a desire to sleep with people of the same sex and more sort of a lack of objection, a lack of bigotry against people who would want to do that.
Kat, how are older members of the LGBTQ+ generation reacting to this? I guess we could call it a trend, but reacting to this movement?
I think that some feel it is a form of kind of stolen valor. Some feel that it's just kind of entertaining or funny. I think that the main concern is that you don't want to, at a moment where support for LGBT protections seems to be waning somewhat, that people are reluctant to structure the movement for gay rights around people who are identifying as bisexual or as gay, but don't have a sort of a behavioral component attached to it.
And is the conversation that it seems like a lot of these conversations are happening online? I mean, how do you think that the rise of social media has contributed to this movement?
I think the rise of social media has done a lot to kind of push these conversations into that abstract realm that we've been talking about. When you are no longer talking about what you physically want to do, and especially when you've never physically done it, as they say, it's sort of akin to taking somebody who's like only ever eaten baby food and bringing them to a restaurant and handing them a menu and saying, what do you like? What do you want on this menu? And what are they going to say? They're just going to be like, well, everything looks fine. I don't theoretically object to any of this. So I guess I'm cool with all of it. When you don't have the expectation that you're going to follow up your identified orientation with the actual real life experience of getting naked with somebody, it does take things to a very kind of a theoretical place.
Now, speaking of the opposite of a theoretical place, you were in Cancun during spring break, and we can talk at a different time about how you ended up there. But you observed quite a few Gen Zers in their sort of native habitat cavorting. What did you see?
For the sake of delicacy, I don't want to go into too much detail, but I think suffice to say that if this is supposed to be a generation that is eschewing heterosexual encounters, at least some of them did not get the memo.
To build on the statistics that you quoted earlier, you said this is also the Gallup organization just came out with a poll that said this is Gen Z is the quote queerest generation ever, according to how people identify, right?
Yeah, that is one way of looking at it. And I think that the only way to understand that is to recognize that for Gen Z, queer means something really very, very different from what somebody my age or your age, somebody older would imagine it as. And also something different even from what the Gallup organization initially set out to track. And I think that it's telling, initially when they first started tracking this data, they just counted like the total percentage of people who identify as LGBT. They didn't break it out into, well, who's gay, who's transgender, who's bisexual. And then in recent years, as there's been this sort of explosion in people who are identifying as members of sexual or gender minorities, they have started looking more granularly at the data and at what it's saying. So I think that we're just seeing kind of a paradigm shift in how young people conceive of sexual orientation as something that's almost more an expression of what kind of person they want to be or want to be seen as. It's less attached to how they might actually be living offline.
And you also note, though, that Gen Z is the least sexually active generation in modern history. Right?
Yeah, they do seem to be on track for that.
Despite Cancun.
Yes. I should say there probably is a selection bias there when you end up in Cancun with the type of Gen Zs who go to Cancun for spring break. I think probably that's a different contingent than the ones who are extremely online trying to choose exactly the right flag to put in their bio, exactly the right pronoun, and perhaps who are the respondents driving what seems to be this big trend in queer ID amongst people that age.
Do you see any dangers to this or any potential downsides?
Not really. I'm sorry, that's a very dissatisfactory answer. But no, I mean, it's hard to see how it really matters. If there were a big sort of behavioral component that was happening in correlation to the increased LGBT identification amongst Gen Zers, I would say maybe we'd want to not necessarily worry about it, but look at it, what's driving it. The fact that this is sort of divorced from any behavioral aspect, that it's not really bleeding out into meat space, that it really seems a lot to do with how people conceive of themselves and how they want to be seen when it comes to this sort of performance of selfhood that we take part in on social media, it just doesn't seem like it's anything necessarily worth particularly getting upset about.
Well, Kat, it's a really interesting article. Great analysis. And we loved having you on to talk about it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
Let's move on to the world of filmmaking and escapism. Sam Wasson, a writer at large for Airmail, has had an intriguing sit-down conversation with the one and only Woody Allen, someone we have not heard from in many years, certainly not in the press. He's been largely avoidant. And I can't wait to hear what Sam has to say. Sam Wasson is a writer for Airmail. He is an author of many books, including most recently, The Path to Paradise, Francis Ford Coppola story. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, thank you.
Sam, before we get into the meat and potatoes of your meeting with Woody Allen, I need to know all of the superfluous details. Where were you? What was he like? How did you find him?
I still can't believe it happened. He lives on the Upper East Side, which is exactly where you want to find him, in a brownstone. That's where I met. I actually went to the actual house. And how I met him was through a friend of Ash's, Ash Carter at Airmail, had a mutual friend and made the introduction. I still can't believe it. All the details. There's so many. Here's the headline, I think, about Woody is that his whole career, he's said that that guy on screen is not him, that character that he plays. And I've always found that hard to believe, given how well he does it, how long he's done it, how powerful it is, how regularly he does it. But in fact, it's really not true. It's really an exaggerated version of him. He's not this phobic, nervous, manic, nebbish in real life. He's really low-key and sanguine. And being with him was so easy. That was something that I really wanted to convey in the piece, the sense of Woody as just almost as a zen-like guy.
Sam, we haven't heard much from Woody in recent years, although we've heard an awful lot about him. Why has he been so reticent to speak to the press?
My guess is because the press is not on his side. I mean, certainly not impartial, certainly not waiting to accept the possibility that he's innocent until proven guilty. Also, he doesn't really need it. Something else that I go into in the piece is how Woody's not really invested in if his movies do well or they don't do well. And in that sense, he's a special case. He doesn't need to promote them. He knows they won't be that big of a hit if they hit, most likely, and they won't flop. So as we know from being Woody fans, he churns them out and then forgets about them and isn't obligated to endorse them. But because we had a mutual friend in common and he was having trouble getting distribution with this picture, Coup de Chance, his latest movie, I think he thought that finally maybe some press would serve him.
And what's it about?
It came out April 5th. And it's in the vein of Match Point and Crimes and Misdemeanors. It's one of his nihilistic adultery murder suspense stories. What's different about this picture is that it's shot entirely in France, in French. He wrote it for Americans in France and then realized, why am I not just using the French? And Paris is, as we know, like New York, one of the few cities where Woody feels at home.
Sam, for a while, a lot of actors, including those with whom he'd worked for many years, have spoken against him and denounced their associations with him, but he still managed to cast this movie. So how do you find that the acting community is embracing him or not?
It's a few actors who are denouncing him by not so magnanimously, in some cases, I believe, giving their money back, their salaries. But Woody never famously doesn't pay much. There are also actors who would stand by Woody. I mean, a lot of them are afraid to say it in the press. Some aren't. Some have said it in the press and been knocked for it. But yeah, no, Woody is beloved by most actors. And I think there are more of them who are quiet than vocal, unfortunately.
Sam, this is his 50th film, correct?
Yeah.
What I think is so wonderful about your stories, you have a sit down with someone who has one of the rare perspectives to look back over a career and over an industry that's evolved and changed and is changing. What did you learn most from him? What do you take away from this sit down that sort of sticks with you about when you talked about his career and the art that he works in?
I'm really glad you brought that up because, like you said, he's been doing this for a long time, longer than I've been alive. He was very sad about what he thought was the end of the glamour of movies, the charisma of people who work in the movie business, which is true. That has really been compromised over the years. And also the problems of exhibition and distribution, that we don't go to the movies. And the movies that play the theaters, most of them play the theaters for only 1 or 2 weeks, which really compromises movie culture and our shared sense of movie going, which really was once our great American pastime. So we don't share the movies anymore. And that's a very sad thing to Woody and to those of us who believe not just in the power of movie going as art and entertainment, but the power of movie going as our cultural unconscious. So he's very sad about that. And he's not wrong to be.
Sam, he's taken such a beating in the press and reputationally. For the past few years, many people have denounced all of his movies, despite the fact that Michael and I will say for the record, we still love them. And we can't get through life without watching Manhattan at least once a year. How does Woody seem to have dealt with all of this? I mean, in terms of his spirits, have they been dampened?
No. And that's something I touch on in the piece very gently in the end, actually. He said something that was so astonishing and moving to me that even though I didn't want to cover the scandals and the allegations in this, I really wanted to look at Woody as a filmmaker today. What he said was so, like I said, moving that I put it in the piece. I really don't want to give it away, but to answer your question, he has proceeded with life and seems to be unchanged. Now, in his deep private self, I don't know. And we didn't talk about it. I really wanted to make a point of not addressing it, of not going in there wanting to write about this. It's been covered. And we need to know about Woody the filmmaker, Woody the man, Woody the cultural giant who's influenced all of our lives, whether we know it or not. And wanted to pay him the homage of not asking him too much about this. I really wanted to talk about Woody the filmmaker. What a concept. And also talk to him about his laziness as a filmmaker. And I say that as someone who couldn't possibly respect him more. And he's so open about his shortcomings as a filmmaker. I wanted to go with that.
Sam, what is your favorite Woody Allen movie?
Along with the ones that everyone picks, Annie Hall and Manhattan. I think Husbands and Wives, but it changes with the seasons. I guess I'm in a Husbands and Wives mood right now. Maybe that doesn't really say the best thing about me, but I'm a human being. It's a great movie, and Sidney Pollack in it is unbelievable. Bullets Over Broadway was a literal before and after moment for me when I saw that movie, and I thought, wow, movie really is a literary experience, cinematic experience. It's a musical experience. It really is all the art forms come together in one. I saw that in Bullets Over Broadway. It's just so beautiful visually and obviously so beautifully written. I was astonished when I saw it in the theater, and I've never been the same.
Sam, I want to go back for a second to what you talked to Alan about his shortcomings as a director and what he revealed to you, because I was surprised as well. He talks, compares himself to Mike Nichols a little bit and also with budgets. But can you tell us a little bit about what he confessed to you about his artistic shortcomings?
He admitted to being lazy, which was good to hear because I felt he's been lazy for 20 years.
How does that manifest itself on the screen in his work?
Well, Woody's always used the master shot, and he's always at his best used it well. But in the last 20 years, it seems to be kind of dead and the path of least resistance.
The master shot is full frame, everyone in one.
Yeah, it's shooting the scene in full frame without cutting. And sometimes that can be really expressive and the right choice. Other times, because it's just one setup, it can be lazy. Bad directors hide behind the fact that they give the actors freedom. Well, they're not really doing their job to give the actors that much freedom that really divests them of the responsibility of directing. And I think Woody's hidden behind a lot of that. His movies don't have the same visual life that they once did. And I wanted an answer for that. And he answered what I expected him to answer, which is he said the actors like it and also that he's lazy. And that's an amazingly honest answer. And I wanted people to read that also, because those of us who've been watching these movies for 20 years and going, where's Woody? I don't want audiences to feel insane that, wait, something's changed. The thrill has gone. We'll be fans forever, but it ain't what it used to be. Something in Woody has gone dry, I think, as a filmmaker. Now, as a writer, he's as powerful as ever. His memoir, Apropos of Nothing, is sensational. So if Woody stopped making movies, which he's threatening to do because they're now so hard to make, they're now so hard to get financed, he says he'll write. And I wouldn't think that would be a bad thing. In fact, I think that would be a better thing artistically than if he were to go on making movies.
Sam, one of the things that really struck me over the context of this conversation and also your story is that the guy's made 50 movies. Let's say 30 of them are completely brilliant and works of art. Like, it's still a great legacy, even if the past 20 years perhaps haven't lived up to expectations. He's not a young guy. He's in his 80s, right? Late 80s?
88.
He's 88. I mean, I hate to be premature on talking about his legacy, but how do you think that we're going to remember him?
I think we're going to remember him as, we won't think of him as the greatest filmmaker. We will think of him as one of the most iconic, and it's an overused word, but in this case, it's the right one, iconic filmmakers of the 20th century, up there with Chaplin. I mean, the name means something in comedy. It means something about love and anxiety and the way we urban people have lived over the last 50 years that has spawned a view of romantic comedy, as the tagline of Annie Hall was, a nervous romance, that we'll never be able to go back from. We'll never be able to go to a world that was pre-Woody Allen now. And it's unimaginable to think of being a conscious, educated person in the world without some relationship to this guy's work and his three-dimensional talent. I mean, it's like a Noel Coward or Oscar Wilde or an Orson Welles even, the ability to have all of these abilities combined together. So I think we also have an expression, unlike other great filmmakers, that seems so personal because we know he writes it. We know it's him. We know it comes from his life, even if it's not directly him. So that filmmaker to audience relationship, I can't really think of a filmmaker who gives himself so deeply and in so many ways.
Well, Sam, it's an incredible story on every level. Please go read it. This is not enough just to talk about it here. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you so much for this incredible analysis.
I'm so glad you highlighted it. Meeting him was one of the best days of my life.
Bye, Sam.
Bye.
Michael, what I wouldn't have given to be in that room with Sam and Woody.
Yeah, I can just see you like, Woody, tell me everything about Manhattan and Annie Hall.
Also, I have to say, I'm a big fan of interiors in September. I like kind of the moodier, lesser known 70s films as well.
Yeah, and let's not forget the early comedies like Take the Money and Run, the goofy ones.
Bananas,
of course.
Zelig.
See, you can just keep going.
We could be here all day, Michael, but instead, let's move on to a new movie, Civil War.
Yeah, this is a film that's got me and my anxiety quite heightened, Ashley.
Why is that?
Because it deals with stuff that's already in my mind, which is a looming civil war in America, but it takes it to a dramatic turn by a fantastic director named Alex Garland, who's made more than a few films that have freaked me out.
Indeed. Well, we've got Michael Strego here to make sense of this all for us. He is a longtime film critic and columnist who has written for many magazines and newspapers, including the San Francisco Examiner, the New York Times, and the New Yorker, the Atlantic, and Salon. He has also written several books, including most recently, Victor Fleming, an American Movie Master. Welcome, Michael.
Good to see you, Ashley and Michael. How are you?
We are hearing so much about this new movie, Civil War, from Alex Garland, and you have actually seen it. So what should we be looking for?
Well, to me, it's the equivalent of those great moments in old movies when the veteran warrior or reporter would take the young recruit who's hysterical and unhinged and slap him hard in the face. That's what it's trying to do to the audience. And it does it. Not an attempt to analyze the political situation. And I completely respect that. It's an attempt to show what happens when politics completely devolves into factionalism, tribalism, and the worst kind of violent retribution.
Well, that sounds familiar. Give us the plot points.
Basically, it follows a group of reporters who are trying to get from New York City to Washington, D.C., which is besieged by a rebel army called the Western Forces. They hope to get there and get what may be the last interview with the President of the United States, who is played by Nick Offerman. We really don't know that much about the president and why all this is happening. We have a little vignette of him at the beginning declaring that his army is on the verge of a great victory. And we gather that he's a blowhard. Just by the way, the writer-director Alex Garland intercuts that speech with very violent and striking graphic images rioting in the streets. So we have a president who, again, is denying reality. And though he's not at all a Trump clone or anything like that, we see how the trust into government can erode from this position very much at the top. And then what happens is as they go on the road, they have to go, all the highways we've been told are vaporized. So it becomes the road movie as they go through Western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Virginia, to try to get to DC. And along the road, they see how society has completely disintegrated in the midst of this breakdown of any kind of political form.
Now, in the hands of a lesser filmmaker, this could be a box office flop. But we are talking about it now because this is Alex Garland, who's behind it. So who is Garland? And tell us about some of his previous work.
Well, Garland is one of those individual and ambitious movie makers working today. And that's one reason I'm just excited about this movie. He takes big swings, even if he doesn't have the big budgets. And he's made the kind of sci-fi movies that actually have ambiguity and humor, very dark humor often. His big directorial debut, his big hit was Ex Machina, which introduced most audiences to Alicia Vikander, who played a robot. The whole movie was based on judging the motivations of her completely sentient and seemingly completely human robot against the ambitions of her crazed maker, Oscar Isaac. So Ex Machina was a big hit. He next made Annihilation, a much more difficult, much more sweeping sci-fi movie about a shimmer, it's called, that lands on southern eastern coast of the U.S. and is some kind of mysterious force from outer space that refracts everything in its path, including DNA. And so to me, it was like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but done as a self-conscious art movie. He accepts things that other directors think will be too complicated to get into. I mean, he's interested in these borders, which is so great. And so it makes sense that in Civil War, he's excited about showing us how what happens when borders break down. I mean, he means it as a wake-up call, a warning cry, an SOS. And even though I think that limits the film, I mean, that really is what the film is. It's showing a portrait of combat reporters thrown into this chaos and really trying to keep their craft and some semblance of their humanity. But we're really just seeing all this stuff as a social political nightmare. And to me, the great movie that does something similar to this is Ingmar Bergman's Shame, which I want you to go see now. It's on the Criterion Channel. It is Bergman's least known great movie, which is about a couple thrown into the middle of a civil war in a rural part of an unnamed imaginary European country. But there, all the disintegration, all the horror is filtered through the personal story of this married couple. What we see in Civil War isn't anything like that. We see Kirsten Dunst, who's terrific, as the veteran photographer who is trying to introduce the young upstart to the ways of this vicious world.
Michael, what do you make of the timing for the release of Civil War? I mean, as we're in this hotly contested run-up to the U.S. election.
I am all for getting these things out and messing with them. I'm not one for saying, you know, it's too soon or the wrong time to do a movie about violence, disagreement, and social breakdown when we seem to be facing that. I think you'd want to have a movie out there that gets people talking. To me, it reminds me of what happened in the late 60s and early 70s when we did have a bunch of movies that did that, ranging from the ones everyone knows about, like Easy Rider, to the ones people have forgotten, like Joe, which starred Peter Boyle as a working class anti-hero who actually mows down hippies. I mean, and kind of echo the contemporary news story at the time. So to me, this is the perfect time to get the movie out here, get people debating about it, get people worried about what happens when different sides of political issues and religious issues and all issues stop talking to each other.
I've seen the trailer only. My anxiety level spiked. I look at Garland, the guy who made 28 Days Later, which also caused me great nightmares.
Yeah.
But referencing some fantastic classic movies on that Criterion Channel, I also think about, like, what's interesting about this film is 20 or so years ago, we had different kind of films, maybe less distinguished, but things like Red Dawn or Independence Day, where the enemy was from without, and this is the enemy within, of course. So just coming at a different time, but it seems to be landing in a sense of, like, now the battle is within us. I'm interested to hear you say that it's good to get it out there, and it's good to sort of, like, have this thing to debate and then have a conversation about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I should say, it is, in a way, a horror movie. I mean, it is like 28 Days Later, in a way, which was a road movie also up through Great Britain. And it is somewhat like the movie he wrote and really co-directed without credit, Dread, which was, to me, the best RoboCop movie ever made, even though a hero isn't a robot, but he's in a kind of suit that gives him RoboCop-type powers. The thing about the movie being made from within, the big line that they're pushing is the Kirsten Dunst character says, I used to take photos of this from war zones abroad, and I used to send them back and think they were warnings, and now look where we are. We're in the middle of the same kind of vicious chaos. But my feeling about the movie is, apart from its visceral force, is that it's not done from within as an American, unfortunately. I think that's one of the limitations of the movie. We go through all these spots that are very scary in themselves, different kinds of combat. But I think for him to keep it at this level, at this journalistic sort of docu-horror level, and to keep us engaged, he needs to have kind of different scenes that really show the kind of broken tapestry of American life. And there are only one or two times when he actually does that. There's a great scene that's almost like a Twilight Zone in miniature of these reporters getting on this nerve-wracking trip, and they get into this oasis of a small town where mothers are working their strollers down the green lawns. I mean, it's almost like a David Lynch small town. And there's a David Lynch twist at the end, and I won't give the spoiler for that. But we need more of that, more of a sense of what life during wartime actually looks like, as opposed to this sense that every single inch of the American landscape has become a front. But it is still very exciting.
Michael, last question. Where can we see this movie? Is it going direct to theaters?
This will be open in theaters. It will be a big release. It's from the production company A24, which is really kind of like a brand like Disney for movie-going crowds now. I mean, they did the Oscar-winning Everything Everywhere All at Once, a movie that I thought was like really silly. But they managed to get sort of crowds across all the box office quadrants to come see their movies. And I think they know how to do that. They do it with social media. They do it with very smart promotion. And this movie has something going for it. I mean, it really has this explosive core of interest. So I think it will be a big hit. And in some ways, it deserves to be. It's limited, but we need movie makers who are kind of fearless. And Alex Garland is not only fearless, but he's also very talented. So I think this is one to see.
Well, Michael, thank you so much. We always love talking to you about movies and the world we live in. Hope to speak to you again soon or see you in the theater.
Okay. Thank you, Ashley. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Michael.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our weekly culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Okay, Michael, it looks like we have our homework on the film front.
Yeah, lots of good things to watch. Some enjoyable, some in French, some a little dystopian, but good selections.
I didn't realize you could divide movies into enjoyable and French categories. Funny. Well, on that note, I know it's the weekend. We are going to escape from the world for a while. What do you have to recommend to us?
Well, we've just given you many things to watch. Ashley, I'm going to give you one thing to listen, and I feel like you're going to have some input on this as well. Can we talk about the album I've been had on repeat in this house with Brooke and me for the last few weeks, Cowboy Carter, the new Beyoncé album?
I don't know anyone who hasn't listened to this album and who doesn't love it.
Oh my God. Let's just start with maybe one of the best duets ever between her and Miley Cyrus.
I thought you were going to say Dolly Parton.
See, everyone's got an opinion. I love Two Most Wanted, Miley Cyrus, which is this heartbreakingly beautiful duet. So you like the Dolly Parton duet?
I do. I like the Dolly Parton duet. I kind of like all the music on it. I like Texas Hold'em too. I honestly can't get it out of my head. Listen to it on repeat at the gym.
I can't get Levi's Jeans out of my head. I can't get Two Most Wanted. And also, I got to tell you, her interpretation of the Beatles song Blackbird is so beautiful.
Yeah, I think even Paul McCartney would approve. It's a good one.
Yeah. If you haven't checked out the new Cowboy Carter album by Beyoncé, that's my recommendation. And you, my dear, what do you have for us?
Well, we have an exciting, thrilling new issue of AIRMEL Look that has just been released into the world, edited by our own Linda Wells. It is a wild romp through the worlds of beauty and wellness, and you do not want to miss it. There are so many good stories within, including Linda's take on the sexification of sunscreen. Yes, you heard that right. Sunscreen is now medicinal. It is, in fact, integral to the complete naked beach experience. We've got a treatise on peak lips. And if you don't know what that is, then that means you are not getting yours filled. And maybe it is time to stop or start or something. But Brennan Kilbane reports on that trend phenomenon for us. And we have a fascinating story too about a new infidelity coach. This is a guy who teaches you to be unfaithful in the name of preserving your relationship. So do not miss that. Alexander Shulman, who is the longest serving editor of British Vogue, talks about Amy Winehouse, who's the subject of a new biopic from Sam Taylor Wood called Back to Black. And Amy's look in terms of her fashion and her beauty persists and is as discussed as ever. So all that and more in the new issue of AIRMEL Look. You can get it at airmail.news/look.
Can't wait.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us. We all have a lot to do this weekend, so we got to get out of here. Michael, will you please read us out?
Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. Our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AIRMEL is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AIRMEL Weekly, but we will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting. In the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music, but most of all, thank you again for joining us.